taking notes on a script. No one wants to do it. I used to hate it. I still hate it. No one likes it. It's awful, but it's absolutely, it is probably more than half the job.
Welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. I feel a bit bereft today as I'm getting ready to share this last episode of the first series. You'd never know when you produce something like this whether it's going to land or not with other people, and I can't tell you how happy I've been to hear from so many of you who are enjoying it. I hope I'll be back soon enough with more writers just as brilliant as the first 10. But in the meantime, do catch up on any episodes of the series that you've missed, and it would be a big help if you would rate, review and share them. Thank you so much to everyone who has already. You heard just now from today's guest, the humorist Charlie Brooker. When I first met Charlie, he was the journalist behind Screenburn, his very funny and popular column in The Guardian, and he was in the relatively early days of becoming the hugely successful TV writer that he is now. His CV includes both on-screen cultural commentary stuff, like the BBC's Screen Wipe and Channel 4's 10 o'clock live, and off-screen writing on shows that are either daft or dark or sometimes a bit of both. The sitcom Nathan Barley, which mocked a certain type of new media idiot in East London, is one of them. Then there was the comedy drama Dead Set, which explored what might happen if there were a zombie outbreak during a series of the reality show Big Brother. But today, what Charlie's best known for around the world, actually, is Black Mirror, a series that he created for Channel 4 in 2011 and subsequently took to Netflix. At my count, it's won 7 Emmys, although it's been nominated for and won so many awards that I found it genuinely quite confusing trying to count them up. If you haven't seen it, it's a science fiction anthology series, in the sense that each episode stands alone as a little drama, broadly themed around the future possibilities of technology. There's always a satirical undertone to Charlie's work, and he's got an instinct for taking an element of modern life, following it to its most ludicrous conclusion and showing us how we're living in a whole new light. People often expect Charlie to be sort of lovably grumpy, because his on-screen and on-the-page persona has at times been heavily sarcastic, but he's not really like that at all. He's a kind, generous person, and considering he's insanely busy in his professional life and also has 2 kids, I was very grateful to have this time with him. We spoke in December at his house in London, in the front room that he's using as a temporary study, which is full of the aforementioned awards, props from Black Mirror, books, video games, and things his kids made at school. Quick warning that this is quite a sweary episode. So, over to Charlie.
This is not where I normally write. Where I normally write is in a small little office room upstairs. Which is, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
It's a shithole. It's a fucking shithole. Sorry, no, that's, I'm so childish. Sorry. It's a mess. Usually, this is a bit messy, but I usually write in a much smaller room than this. This is like a living room.
So how did you end up here?
Because we're having the loft done.
Okay.
And there were people banging about and taking the roof off.
You have sort of turned it into a bit of a makeshift study, in that you were saying you've sort of gathered quite a lot of study-related mess around your computer.
Well, yeah. Well, wherever I sit, if I sit anywhere for any length of time, I start to accumulate, like, just detritus.
Right.
Basically, around, like, wrappers of things, like envelope, you can hear like sound effects for the, like a Radio 4 play. Sound effects.
Are you going to walk on gravel?
Yes. Cables, always lots of cables and leads, and bit like there's a little plate. And now, before you came round, I removed about 8 mugs from this room.
Okay.
And then, like, now there's like only 4 or something in front of, like, yes. And there's a sort of big that thing, which is this arcade joystick that you plug into a TV and has lots of pirated games on it and things like that. So there's just always piles of crap around.
Well, so tell me a bit about your actual study and what, you know, if you're sitting at your desk upstairs,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
What can you see? What are the things you have around you that you like to have around you?
Well, you see, again, it's basically the mistake you've made there is ask me what I've got around me that I like to have around me. And I think most of the time, in fact, all the time when I write, I end up surrounded by things I don't want around me, but that I sort of forget are there. And every so often I sort of look around me and go, oh my God, this place is a total mess. I'm disgraceful. And yeah, so actually I'm usually surrounded by things I don't realize are there.
Okay.
If that makes sense. And usually what I'm doing, so there's a monitor here. There's a great big light monitor. It's very similar to this. It's facing the wall. So it's not like I'm looking out over a nice view of like a tree or anything. It was right. Nature. I'm staring at a wall and a monitor. And life is behind me. So the window is behind me usually. So most of the time I'm... Yes. Ah, now the one thing that is a detail is that upstairs, usually I've got... So the monitor and the keyboard and all of that sort of thing are on a thing that you can raise up and down, a bit like a standing desk, basically. So I sometimes write standing up.
Bad back.
Bad back, and also, weirdly, a good anti-procrastination device.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, once you... Now, but it only works under certain circumstances, because if you know what it is you've got to write... So say I've done the outline for a script and I know basically what the storyline is and I've just got to, then it's good to be standing up because you write more quickly. You get less distracted because you don't think, I'll Google how a helicopter works so that this scene is more authentic. And then like 2 hours later, you're sort of watching dogs catching tennis balls in their bums or whatever it is. You know, like, you don't do that because it's a bit uncomfortable standing up. So you don't want to waste time. You just want to get it over and done with. However, if you're in the stage of trying to think up the storyline or you're a bit stuck, it doesn't help, I find, to stand up.
So what is your sort of writing...
Ice,
you don't have to do all the sound effects.
Sounds like I'm having a whiskey, you know, doesn't it? It's water. Yeah.
What's your sort of writing routine? Are you writing every day or?
It depends on what mode I'm in. Yeah. So generally speaking, I've got a lot better at planning, which I never used to do. I used to just try and write scripts as I went along. And which sometimes works, but more often than not, I'd end up in terrible trouble having to rewrite something at the last minute. And when we did, we did two series of Black Mirror that way with me writing it sort of as I went along. And then when we went to do the third, originally Channel 4 had greenlit a third series that then didn't happen. But one of the things they stipulated was we want all the scripts in advance. We wanted to know what's going on because there was one episode that I rewrote completely 48 hours about, like in 48 hours in a panic. It turned out to be one of the best ones we'd done. I think it was called White Bear, but I totally rewrote it. It was
because it wasn't working.
Because it wasn't working, but it was happening anyway because we'd run out of time. And then I suddenly thought of a much better twist to have happening in it. And so I rewrote the whole thing very, very quickly. But ever since then, I've planned things a lot more, which makes life a lot easier. So if I'm in planning mode, that's generally conversational to start with. I will be, and you don't do actually much writing. You're just chatting through the idea, either with whoever is nearby or often with me. It's often with Annabelle Jones, who's co-showrunner on Black Mirror. Occasionally we've had other writers in and we have a sort of brainstorming day. Sometimes I'm just on my own, like thinking something up, and then I have to write an outline, which I hate doing. That's my least favorite thing, is writing the outline version of something.
Why
do I hate it?
Yeah,
because it's, you sort of feel like, it's like you know what you want to do and someone's making you explain it in detail before you do it. So it's a bit like, oh, I want to go on holiday somewhere. I know exactly where I want to go. And you can't book it until you describe, like,
what you'll do every day.
What you'll do every fucking day. And of course, you don't know what you're going to do by day eight. Like, you don't know. So you just start making it up. And also sometimes when you're writing, you know, if you're writing something that's quite long, you might not know the answer to something that's like, you know, for want of a better phrase, third act problem. I don't think in terms of acts, by the way, so I don't know why I'm using that phrase, but you don't know, you think, oh, well, you trust yourself to solve it when you get there, but you have to solve it in the outline, and then people can pick it apart and call you a fucking idiot. So for all those reasons, I don't like doing it, but it's a necessary evil. Because but when I'm doing that, I find it very hard to focus for any length of time because I hate it so much. So I'll sort of have to break that down into chunks of like 20 minutes. And like anyone else, I suddenly find that I'm on the internet, and before you know it, 2 hours have gone by, and I'm like, you sort of wake up and go, what am I? Oh no, what am I doing? And there's a lot of self-loathing there.
That's actually something that's cropped up quite a lot in the interviews.
Really? Self-loathing and self-loathing. Procrastination.
Quite a central part of writing.
I think it is about 80% of it is thinking I'm not doing this properly. Like I'm not doing it and I'm not doing it properly. So there's a lot of that. And then I sort of break it up and I walk around. With any luck, what happens is, and I'll usually put music on as well, but it's always instrumental sort of music. I can't listen to anything with lyrics. So that helps you then get into what hopefully happens is after a while something clicks and then you're just writing and you lose track of the time. So hopefully that happens. Now, that's the outlining phase. When you're in the, oh God, I've got to really write this, I tend to write, if I know what it is I've got to do, because I've got the outline and someone has greenlit it and I know it's definitely going to happen, which is another big psychological barrier to get over, is knowing it's definitely going to happen, I can write very, very, very fast. But I will do it in when I say fast, I mean just in terms of alterna-scripting in a couple of days. But, you know, I've been up all night,
right.
Sort of. But then I quite enjoy that sometimes.
Yeah, I mean... I remember seeing you back in the days when you were doing your Guardian column and sometimes, if you don't mind me saying so, spending quite a few hours going, well, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to write about, and then just very, very quickly doing it.
Yes, that's the point.
And
at
it
which
being very funny.
Well, hopefully. Well, sometimes. Well, the thing is, it's the point at which the fear, I think I've heard somebody else describing this once, the fear of not handing anything in overtakes the self-loathing and laziness. Yeah. Basically, it's the combination of like, I don't want to do that. Oh, God, no, don't make me do that. I don't want to do it. And then the deadline kicks in and it's like a personal trainer standing behind you going, just bloody do it. And so you've got to just bloody do it. And in just bloody doing it, you solve all sorts of problems, or hopefully something clicks and you find yourself enjoying it. Usually when I was writing those newspaper columns, it was like being dragged through I was like a dog that didn't want to be dragged into a bath. Do you know what I mean? And then what would happen is something would click and you'd realize, oh, I've gone way over my word count and now I've got to go back and prune things out. So I haven't really got much better at the I want to do this bit,
yeah.
If you see what I mean. But I have got much more regimented, and I can plan things, and then I'm much better now at working out how much time it will take me to do and actually doing it.
Yeah.
But I'll do, and I tend to do things quite quickly, and which I never admit to anyone. Obviously, I pretend it's going to take longer.
Now that your writing is predominantly for television, if not all for television.
Yeah, I've forgotten how to write columns. I genuinely have.
Well, I want to talk about that in a bit. But how much of writing now is collaborative? I mean, are there periods where you're sitting around going through a script and changing things with a group of people?
Yeah.
Or with Annabelle?
Well, no, it depends. So yes, if you're talking about like Black Mirror or something like that, so a drama script, what happens is I will do the first draft, and again, it's the other thing is you have to get as long as you get to the end of the first draft, you have to forget how rubbish it is. You know that and you just write things that are filler basically a lot of the time because you just need to get to the end. Then I will give it to, with the first draft, usually I'll send it straight to Annabelle, who will pick it the fuck apart in a way that you always, you can't help but get really defensive.
Really?
Well, of course, because it's like, because someone is going through everything you've written and is going, well, what's all that? We'll have another conversation. Basically, she'll read it and she'll write down a load of notes. During which time, if I reread it, I've got my own like thoughts about what
it's funny how
what, works
once
what
you've given something to someone, you can suddenly see it in a whole fresh, horrifying light.
Exactly. And so that's exactly what's going on. Is she's going through, like, she'll be going through things and saying, well, what am, I don't understand, what's this about, and I didn't like this bit, and so on and so forth. And either I'm going, well, yes, okay, well, it's very first drafty, or it's, yeah, you're completely exposed and you're sort of going, yeah, no, you know, I know. Well, what else should be there? And then you usually think of a solution. Sometimes in defending something, you think of a better way to do it, or it solidifies what you thought. It's a sort of unpleasant process you have to go through, but it always makes things better, basically. It is a bit like, I guess, when people lift weights and it slightly rips the muscle, and then the muscle fixes itself and gets
bigger and stronger.
Obviously, looking at me, obviously I'm a very strong man, right? So it's a process I go through a lot, you know. So you have to go through that. Now, the thing is, by the time you get to the end of the process where you're, hang on, I'll back up a bit. So then that's the first draft. Then you'll get to a point where you're happy to then show this to like Netflix, say, or use it to try and interest directors or cast members, that sort of thing. So it's a bit more polished. But you will still get notes back. So Netflix will come back with their own thoughts. And they're never prescriptive. They never say, you mustn't do this. But they might go, why is the cowboy got the bum problem? Or whatever it is. You know, and you go through the process again. You either think of a solution or you defend it or what have you. Then once there's a producer on board and a director on board, you have the whole conversation again. So it's, now it's like, well, hang on, we can't go to Droitwich to film this. Droitwich is incredibly expensive. Does this bit have to be set in a boat? Do we need this montage? What about, you know, so you have a lot of practical conversation about, often a lot of it is ways of, how can we save a bit of money? Why do we really need all these different locations? Do we need all the, how are we trying? We're trying to make the schedule as efficient as possible. And that's a very, 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 very annoying, but also very necessary part of the process. I can hear seagulls.
It's lovely. It's a nice background atmosphere.
It's weird though, isn't it? Just checking I wasn't having a stroke, and it was just, it was genuinely happening outside my head. I was like, I can hear seagulls. Call an ambulance. Anyway, so you go through that process again. And then you'll have a read through. Incidentally, once you've cast, you'll cast it. And sometimes you rewrite the part depending on who you've cast as well. And then you'll have a read through, and you might rewrite it again after that, thinking, oh, I now know that actor, so I'll tweak it more to their voice. Then you'll have other problems that might come up where you're running out of time, and so you have to drop scenes or something like that during the shoot, or an actor gets sick or something like that, or the location burns down, whatever. So you rewrite it again. And then the final rewrite is in the edit, which I think a lot of writers don't get to go into. I'm very lucky in that because I'm co-showrunner, I can walk in and out of the edit whenever I want and not leave until I'm happy. And it's, I think, the most important draft.
People always talk about this, that the final edit of the script is in the, or the final rewrite is in the edit suite. And I'm always slightly confused by this, because surely all you can really do at that point is cut things out or change the order that they happen in. No,
you can do lots. You can, so apart, I mean, at the most brutal, you can do things like you can cut to the back of someone's head and write a whole new line for the person.
Get someone to record.
Yeah,
it.
So you literally, now in San Junipero, there's a bit where there's a huge bit of that happening. No one ever notices it.
This is a Black Mirror episode from season 3?
2016, yeah. There's a whole chunk where there was something that didn't make sense. So which is often the case, and you spot it all over the place in things. I was watching The Crown, season 3 of The Crown the other day, and there was a very clear bit where it cuts to like Princess Anne listening to Prince Philip, and he sort of goes, well, we're going to do this documentary because it's the first time that the royal family has ever since, this is the year 1967 and Harold Wilson is in charge. It was like, so you can do that sort of thing. You can like make things very clear, which is often if you've cut something else out, you have to do that, so it still makes sense. But you can also totally alter the tone and the mood of what's happening. You can suddenly find a shot of an actor doing something with their face that communicates something that either wasn't in the script or that there wasn't a line of dialogue that communicated it. You can, depending on where you place the focus, you can completely alter the meaning or the feel of a scene. And that's very important. And often, if you're a writer, anyone who's any script writer, anyone I ever speak to who's getting into script writing, you've got to try and get in the edit if you can. They'll keep you out of there if they possibly can. You're the last person they want in. But the reason you should be in there is it's surprising. It's amazing how often directors and editors don't really refer back to the script and just cut it. And like you're sort of going, you think something's not quite right about this. What's going on? And you're like, hang on a minute. This person's just murdered someone and they should be really worried. I remember that. Hang on a minute. And you look back at the script and you'll realise that it's full of descriptions like, you know, she looks shiftily from side to side with beads of sweat forming on her brow. And you go, where's all of this? And they're like, oh, yeah. you know, because you've written this big book of instructions, basically. So you can go back and you can make sure that it's adhering to your notion of how things should play out, but you can also completely alter things, and you can totally alter the mood of things very quickly.
Let's just leave the Black Mirror stuff for now and go back in time.
Yep.
When did you start writing? Were you writing as a kid or a teenager?
I was as a kid. So my first job was writing comic strips, drawing comic strips and writing articles for a kid's comic when I was like 15, 16.
How did you get into that?
I sent something to the letters page and they wrote back and said, would you like to come up with a comic strip for us? And I was like, okay.
That's amazing.
I mean, I didn't speak because they couldn't have heard me from they were in Manchester. but yes, and before that I had wanted to do comedy things. So I used to draw comics, and when I say comics, I mean comic strips, and then I'd collect them together in a comic and I'd put them in we had a sort of box of comics at school, primary school, for when if it was raining at lunchtime so kids could read comics, and I used to draw my own ones and put them in the box. What an attention seeking little twat. And they were really disturbing as well, horrible things. I remember one, it was like something like the ghost shop or something like that, it says. And there's a bloke who runs a shop of horror things. And a bloke comes in and goes, hello, I am an inspector from the government and I'm here to close this shop down. And the guy goes, hang on a minute. And the shopkeeper goes, hang on a minute. And he pulls a lever and the inspector falls through a trapdoor onto some spikes. And the rest of the comic strip was just this man writhing in agony on the spikes.
Slowly dying.
And his eye comes out and he's on a spike. And what the fuck I was thinking. But so I used to do things like that, and I used to watch like comedy on TV, the young ones, and I wanted more of the young ones. So I'd record it and watch it again. And then because I still wanted more of the young ones, I'd sort of write the scripts out by hand, like, which is weird. That's the sort of thing you do, I think, when you're about 13. So I always wanted to do that sort of thing. And then I was very lucky in that I got to sort of write and draw comic strips for a comic when I was still pretty young.
Yeah. And then what was your first sort of grown-up writing job?
Well, I don't think I've had one. No, I mean, probably after that. Well, I mean, in the 90s, I started writing reviews for video games magazines.
PC Zone.
And that was off the back of doing comic strips, weirdly. So, because they'd seen some comic strip adverts I'd done for a video game shop, and they'd asked if I was interested in doing that. And then I befriended some people who worked at the magazine, and one of them said, well, why don't you write some reviews? And I was like, I don't think I'm qualified. Because I hadn't passed my media studies exam. For some reason, I seem to think you needed a qualification to write reviews of computer games. I don't know, what an idiot. And so that was my first regular freelance writing gig, I guess.
At some point you launched TV Go Home, the website.
That was So I started doing a website that was like a parody of the Radio Times. And I started doing it because I used to do comic strips on a website, but I never updated it because comic strips take so long to do. And I thought, if I just set myself the task of doing a small regular thing that I'll update once a fortnight, maybe I'll feel a bit better about myself. and it really was the thing more than anything else that changed my trajectory career-wise. Because at that point, I was doing lots of video games related things. And I was but I felt I was in a bit of a ghetto. And what I really wanted to be doing was just doing comedy stuff generally. And because I started doing that, I was very, very lucky because it caught on and I was doing it anonymously. And I think at that time, this late 90s, people thought it was a huge team of people doing this thing or something like that. Like when it was lucky because I'd learned HTML. And so I sort of knew. So it looked probably more sophisticated than it was. The anonymity gave it a bit of a frisson of something like, who is this person doing this stuff? And that was just cowardice. It was because I was doing a Radio 1 thing, a little technology thing, and my co-presenter had said, if the BBC see you mocking the Radio Times, they will fire you. Yeah. So I changed it. So all these sort of stars aligned, and it meant that I was suddenly offered. So I got a job writing on the 11 o'clock show, which was my first TV comedy writing gig, and The Guardian started approaching me to do articles. And so because it was a TV thing, suddenly I was the TV guy, not the computer games guy. I was the TV, the guy who's writes stupid things about
Rude
Phil
things
Mitchell.
About
yeah.
Yeah.
Or Mick Hucknall. So it meant that because I had set myself this task of doing this small little thing in bite-sized chunks, basically, it meant I had built up this catalogue of work and people could see it and like it. And so it answered the question of, well, how do I break into doing that, if you see what I mean? Because so then people were coming to me to ask if I would do stuff for them, whereas before I didn't know how to make the leap from writing about games into writing about anything else. I just couldn't work it out. When people would say, oh, you need an angle, you need to think of something, think of an angle. I was like, I don't know what that is. I still don't really know.
So your first sort of TV thing was writing on the 11 o'clock show. Mm. But then quite shortly after that, you did Nathan Barley. A couple of years after that, was it?
Actually, 6 years.
Oh, was it?
No, five or six years. Because after that, so we did some stuff that was sort of sketch shows. We did a sketch show version of TV Go Home, 3-4, which was, I was cutting my teeth. I didn't really know what I was doing. And then I wrote some stuff on the Brass Eye Pedophile special, but really that was more, I was sitting in a room with Chris and some other people and just coming out with stupid ideas.
How
basically.
Did you meet Chris?
Through TV Go Home. Through Gia Milinovic, who was my co-presenter on a show I was doing in the 90s, and her then husband was had directed the first series of Brass Eye. So that was a bit, that was cozy. Yes, and then he contributed a few things to TV Go Home, actually. Here's a trivia thing. So his pseudonym there used to be Sid Peach. It would show up as Sid Peach, which you might notice is a character in Succession, if you're a fan of Succession. So I think that's Jesse Armstrong giving Chris
really?
A little... nod
nice.
Back. Why did I get onto that? Yes, and that was a very different process as well, because that was us sitting in a room thinking of stupid things, and then Chris likes to workshop a lot with actors, basically. So we did a lot of workshopping, and then the scripts were written like we worked out the storyline, and then I'd go off and write a scene and email it to him, and he'd write a scene and email it to me, and then it somehow all got stitched together. When it went out, I think it did not do very well, to put it mildly, when it first went out. Not to put it mildly, it didn't rate as well as Channel 4 were hoping, or the rest of us probably. And then I think subsequent to that, it picked up a second wind on DVD, and it turned out to be probably more prescient than we realised probably at the time. It's weird to think it was pre-YouTube and stuff like that. Oh yeah.
That's weird, yeah.
And he's sort of doing a video diary in it. And it's certainly pre-Twitter. It's pre-iPhone. You know, he's obsessed with his phone in it, and he's like, he's got this sort of phone that can film things, and all of this was sort of like sci-fi. We were doing it.
So going back to Black Mirror, it's evolved quite a lot from the first season. I'd say the recent ones are quite different in feel.
Yeah.
And not just because I imagine the budgets have got a lot bigger since he went to Netflix, but also just tonally it feels quite different.
Yes, that's fair.
Yeah. How, from your perspective, how has your approach to it changed?
I'm probably more... What's slightly tricky is that because... Like, when we did the first season, we didn't really know what the show was in some ways. So we knew it was like... It was supposed to be a bit... It was like what-if stories with a technological bent, and it was just meant to feel unlike other things that were around at the time. And that was basically it. And then as it went on, when we started doing the season three, which is the Netflix season, the first time we did a season for Netflix, because we were doing six and before we'd done three in a season, and because to date every single episode we'd done had ended on a horrible, horrible downer, I thought, well, I've got to change what this is, otherwise we'll do six downer endings and it's very predictable. So to deliberately alter what the show was, the first one I wrote was San Junipero, which I mentioned earlier, which has got a much more positive outlook and a more positive...
And it's quite romantic.
It's very romantic. It ends on a high. It doesn't end on a low. It's optimistic about the technology. And it's very glossy and it's extremely American. And that was partly a reaction to me, somebody saying something like, oh, it will be all American now, it's going on Netflix. And I thought, right, fuck you, okay, right. Opening scene, California. But it was deliberate because we thought we've got to expand what the show is, otherwise we'll go mad, basically. So then subsequent to that, we've kept sort of doing... Some of them have got more crowd pleasing. Some of them have probably also got a little more experimental. So you've got an episode like USS Callister, which is a very popular episode, and it's I think a really, really good episode. It's very mainstream for Black Mirror. It's like very, very, you know, it's as close as we get to like a Pixar movie or something like that. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the it's very accessible. It's got jokes in it. It's got this sort of funny ensemble cast, but it's also very Black Mirror. It's very unpleasant in places. But that's not the sort of thing that it would have occurred to me to do probably when we were first doing it. So you've got that, which is a real crowd-pleasing one. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got something like Metalhead or Bandersnatch, which are much more experimental and odd and sort of grim and British and grimy and abrasive. So we've kind of... So that's happened. Definitely we've done more optimistic stories than we used to, where it was very much... You know, they were all a bit the Wicker Man, basically. It was sort of like my tribute to the Wicker Man with an iPhone in it a lot of the time. So we've expanded it in that respect. Now, the other thing is that obviously we're trying to avoid the show becoming a cliche within its own remit, as it were. But what that does mean is that we're constantly annoying people in that, like, if people sit down to watch the show, also I understand that they want to see more of that thing they like. So when they get something like, we did an episode with Miley Cyrus, which because the tone of it, I think, because it was very much a caper, it turned into a caper. And a lot of people went, fuck off. So, you know, whereas I don't see that as anything other than interesting to me, because I'd not written anything like that before. So to me, that's like, I'm enjoying myself here. Oh, a caper. But I can understand that that's always going to annoy people in the way that some people got annoyed by Bandersnatch or got annoyed by Metalhead or what have you.
But you've got a sort of equal opportunities annoying people across the board at different moments thing going on.
Yes, I suppose. So, yes.
You know, does it matter? I mean, as long as you keep doing this wildly varied.
Yes, hopefully.
It sort of looks from the outside, it looks to me like your career has been driven by you doing things that entertained you and other people loving them, and that leading to more and more opportunities. I don't know if you think that's fair. Like, just thinking about the fact that you were doing comic strips for a magazine as a teenager, and then that TV Go Home led to so many opportunities. Yep. Have you always had that motivation just to be making stuff all the time?
I've wondered about that, because sometimes it's one of those things where, I don't know if you find this, I look back at things that, like, that I would have done, I mean, when I was a teenager or something like that. I can't imagine now having the wherewithal to go, I'm going to do a whole comic. I'm going to draw a whole comic, and I'll staple all the pages together myself, and I'll just put it there just in a box, just in case anyone fancies reading it. Or, you know, I think when it becomes a job, your perception of it alters somewhat. So I don't know. I've been incredibly lucky that I've bounced from sort of job to job to job, and haven't had to really sell myself particularly. Haven't had to sort of try and drum up business for myself. I've never been good at that whole, you know, which is a whole deal now that people have to constantly
hustle.
Hustle. Yeah, that's the word I was... See, I didn't even know the word for it. Like, hustling for work. I never had to do too much. And when I did, I was rubbish at it. I didn't know how to do it. And then I was lucky because I sort of would do these things. It looks like I was really confident. Well, if you look back at it, it looks to me like, wow, I was really confident. I knew what I was doing. But I know, because I was there, that I wasn't. That I was like, sort of like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm a loser. I'm messing it all up. Why am I doing this? Why am I wasting my time doing this and that? Like, so it wasn't like, it wasn't a confident sort of thing. It was, I guess, I was very lucky, and a lot of it was the timing. A lot of it was the timing of the TV Go Home thing. The timing of it was perfect, unbeknownst to me, that I was just right in the middle of, before lots of people could do this, because not lots of people were doing sort of that kind of formatted stuff on the internet at that time, and not many people knew how to do it in the TV world, and it was all seen as a bit mysterious and wow, what sort of magic stuff has this guy got that he knows what to, you know. So I was very, very fortunate. I don't know if I was starting out now, I don't know what I'd do. I guess I'd be doing tweets. I'd probably be coming up with, I'd come up with the TV Go Home equivalent, presumably.
For TikTok.
TikTok or something. Or like, yeah. And but because simultaneously the barrier to entry is so low, in terms of, you can now, there are the tools for you to film things, make things, put them up. There's a platform that you can eat.
Anyone can do it.
Anyone can do it, but it means that anyone can do it, so you're up against everyone. So I don't. I don't know where I'd start now, you see, because would I start with the written word, or would I be trying to do scripts, and would I be trying to do animation now, I guess, if I was like 15 now? I don't know. It's not my problem. I'm old now.
Your Wikipedia page, the first thing you were described.
I love this research.
I know, yeah.
Your Wikipedia. But what if I'd edited it just before you came over? Said he was crowned King of Denmark.
I was going to say that the first thing you were described on there is a humorist. Do you see yourself as a humorist? Because, I mean, a lot of what you're doing now is not strictly comedy.
Humorous.
Although it is, there are some laughs.
I don't know. You see, sometimes, like, I think also the other thing you can see, if you look back at the, like, actually my career seems to suddenly alter every 5 years or something. It's like, I've been thinking about this recently. It seems to suddenly, like, I'll be doing one thing and then suddenly I'm doing something quite different, related but different. It's always writing involved, but like quite different. So I don't know, because if you're American, they are quite bewildered to find out that the person who writes Black Mirror does comedy things or has done comedy things in the UK. It doesn't compute for them because I think they maybe don't see the humour in it the way that I do, or that probably a British audience does. I don't know, because I guess now, if you were starting it now, I'm probably not seen predominantly as a humorist. I don't really know what I am.
Do you think your interests have moved away from comedy slightly?
No. Good. I think that there's something I've been thinking about recently, is I would like to do more of that.
Are there lessons that you've learned about writing over the years that have been helpful to you?
Learn the alphabet. It comes in really handy. Learn the alphabet. Know all the letters A to Z. That will really see you right. I guess there are many, actually, which are, and I think they are mainly fairly straightforward or prosaic ones. Try to make yourself do it. Like, because you will constantly be thinking, this is not very good, or this isn't going right, or this is difficult. Just do the bits you can do. Make sure you get to the end of what you're doing, basically, or an end of what you're doing. Don't try not to leave things just half finished. Try and get to the end, because you might find that in doing so, you solve all sorts of problems. Or at least when you walk away and go back, you immediately see what's wrong. And the second time you do it, it's a lot faster and more enjoyable because you know kind of what you're doing. So you have to mentally trick yourself into just getting through the first draft of things. That would be one thing. The other thing, there's one thing I do say to people who are starting out. I think that's the only times in your career as a writer that you'll get to write whatever you want are at the beginning and at the end if you've had lots of success, basically. So at the beginning, you should write just like literally what would you like to read, that rather than, you will end up copying other people's style and stuff, that doesn't matter, but you know, even if you're doing stuff that's almost like fucking fan fiction, it doesn't matter. Do exactly what you want to do, because from that point on, then you'll be hustling for work and you'll be having to slot into other people's needs and concerns and fucking shopping list of stuff that they want. Whereas if you've marked out a good strident voice for yourself, A, you'll know your own voice better, and B, you might not get a chance to do that for quite a while, you know, but you're more likely to get there sooner if you've sort of marked that territory. So try and do that. What else? I mean, it's mainly about just getting through it. The whole thing about rewriting, taking notes on a script, no one wants to do it. I used to hate it. I still hate it. No one likes it. It's awful, but it's absolutely, it is probably more than half the job is getting feedback from people and being annoyed and defensive and then having to go away and simmer for a bit and then think, fuck, they're right. There's like nothing worse. I've now got better at recognizing that they're right while it's coming out of their mouth, like, and thinking, okay. And you have to sort of swallow your natural, because it's just, it is, I read somebody who described it, it's fear. It's basically fear. You are worried that A, you're ashamed that what you've written, they've pulled it apart. And so you just feel some natural animal shame.
Yeah.
Like they've criticized your bum hole or something, which that would be a weird note to give. and also you're just afraid that you're not going to be able to do it properly, or that it's going to be too much work,
or that they've noticed that you're shit, or that you were hoping nobody would notice.
Exactly. You thought you'd get, like, the one thing you were worried about while writing this was, I am shit, this is shit, and they've fucking noticed it. but you have to sort of go through all of that, and it doesn't mean that you have to do what they're saying you should do. It means that, but they are, a lot of the time, they're onto something. And again, somebody else described it much better than me, but they said it's a bit like, they're like a patient going to see the doctor. They might be going, my leg hurts, my leg really hurts. Doesn't mean you saw the leg off. They're just saying, I've noticed a problem, and your job is not to deny it, but to work out how to make it better, basically. So it might be that they might be going, I don't like this character. And it might be that actually the problem is something else, but you shouldn't just dismiss what they're saying out of hand.
Yeah.
So there's that. Oh, there's loads. Try and write standing up now and then. There you go. Plan things if you can. Do things in short little chunks. Even if you set a timer for 20 minutes and do it. Go. The one thing I thought I'd never say is like go running. Things like that. Really good for... Like where people used to say to me, oh, I love going running because I just forget and I can think. And I think, you fucking liar. How can you think anything other than I wish this wasn't happening?
I hate this.
Why is this happening to me? But actually, when you've done it for a while, I find my brain does go on like, I don't know what happens. Something happens and I've had loads of ideas that I then immediately come back and put straight in a script.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
When you look back over what you've done professionally, because you've been working for what,
100 years? I know, it's fine.
Something like that. What are you proudest of?
That's a difficult one. I mean, it depends. As most things I've done, I've got some degree of pride in if I go back and look at them. I think I can appreciate, like, I've gone through the phase of like just seeing the problems and now I can see, oh, that was, oh, I did well there. So I sort of, most of the things I've done on some level I can look at and, you know, I'm very proud of like San Junipero, I'm very proud of Callister, I'm very proud of a lot of the episodes, actually White Bear, most of the Black Mirrors I'm proud of. The Wipe shows, Touch of Cloth, what a big head actually. Touch of Cloth is one thing I think I'm very proud of that got probably overlooked. Not many people saw it because it was, I think because it was on Sky. And sort of, just, I guess, not enough people were watching that on Sky. What do they have Sky for? They watch the fucking football. Pricks. Although I can't really, I mean, Game of Thrones is on Sky. It's not really much of an argument,
is it?
It's
not standing, you know, that's an argument.
Game, have you heard of that? Game of Thrones. Have you ever seen it?
I haven't got Sky.
Most things. I think, I suppose I'm pleased that I'm quite amazed that I've managed to get to do a lot of the things I've done despite, do you know what I mean? I quite quickly got to do, actually, Dead Set, that was my first drama thing. I sort of fell into positions of being able to do these things, being allowed to do these things very quickly, and that's very unusual. So I'm aware I've had a very unusual career trajectory where, because people have noticed I can do one thing, I've sort of fallen into doing another thing, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Because Dead Set came about because I was writing comedy things and TV things. You know, that was why I was listened to. And obviously, being a flipping middle class white guy has really helped. There's no fucking doubt about it. There really isn't. So I've been extremely fortunate. I'm just pleased that we've got away with doing a lot of those things, I suppose. that they haven't immediately. I've had very few comparative. It feels like I haven't had much like people saying that is complete and utter shit. At least not to my face early on. So now there's plenty of people saying that, but they're on the internet somewhere. I don't know.
My last question.
Right.
So. That was the one and only Charlie Brooker. Come and talk to me about this interview or any in the series so far on Twitter. I'm at Hattie Hattie, or you can use the hashtag InWriting. If you've enjoyed it, please share it, rate it, and review it, because that helps it reach more listeners and survive in the podcast world. And I plan to be back soonish with another series. Until then, bye for now.